limited, and we seem to talk less and less about the things that matter in life. The Mother's Catch-22. The net result of society's conventions is that a mother like Grace or Ellen, who's trying to raise a healthy son, finds herself in a difficult catch-22 situation. She is held responsible for a boy's emotional growth and development, and yet she's also expected by society to push him away so he can learn how to survive in a culture that may shame him for showing the very feelings she's teaching him to express. She's supposed to hold back the amount of physical affection she shows him and limit the emotional intensity of her interactions with him, especially as he grows older. Yet she's also expected to consistently nourish her son's self-esteem so that he'll know how to cope with the boy code. It's a painful bind for mothers. Again and again, mothers like Ellen and Grace ask me, "How can I give my boy the love and attention he craves, and still prepare him for the tough male culture?" Are mothers confused, or is it all of us? Many mothers I know would love to fight for the right to stay connected to their sons. But part of the reason they hold back is that they become overwhelmed by society's myths about boys, especially the myths we've spoken of, that boys will be boys and that boys should be boys. Some moms throw up their hands, mutter something about testosterone, and turn to their husbands and other experts about how to raise their sons. The advice they get is usually similar to what Grace and Ellen heard from others. Things like, "Don't be so close and mushy with him. Stop babying him. And let him be more independent." Mothers may find it easier to engage in battle for the sake of their daughters. "We know what little girls need," they say firmly. "But boys, well, boys are a different story." And so mothers learn to distrust their best instincts, curb the natural flow of love and empathy they feel for their young boys, and participate in the push to prematurely separate from their sons. Michael Gurion, a leader in the new men's movement, believes that mothers are simply confused by boys. "We don't educate moms very well in how to raise kids, especially how to raise boys. Moms weren't brought up in male cultures and don't have male bodies, so that's harder for them. We don't educate them about how active their little boys are, how testosterone affects them. The boys will act up in ways that don't make sense to them." I disagree. The problem for boys is not that mothers are confused by them. Mothers today and throughout history are simply part of a culture. And it is our entire culture that is confused about masculinity and therefore about how to raise boys. Mothers have been confused by mixed messages about boys and masculinity in the same way that teachers, coaches, clergy, grandparents, children, and men themselves are confused. So if mothers are to be helped, mothers who are usually given primary responsibility for raising our sons in their earliest years, and who must first struggle with these mixed messages about boys and masculinity, it is society as a whole that must clarify the best way to support our boys as they grow toward manhood. A new kind of mother, a new kind of boy. If we really think carefully about it, many of the qualities today's mothers are trying to develop in their boys, far from being feminine qualities or qualities that women will tend to reject in the men they choose to love, are actually the very qualities most of today's women seem to be urging their male partners to develop. I firmly believe that as a society the time has come to encourage women to trust their instincts when it comes to mothering a boy. For as society begins to put a premium on emotionally intelligent, verbally capable, empathic, loving men, there could probably be no better way to cultivate such new men than by starting to cultivate such new boys. So if we're beginning to officially revise the boy code so that it's considered a plus for boys and men to have these special qualities, let us also revise this code so that it's considered a real plus for boys to remain close to the people who are often best positioned to teach them these qualities, their mothers. But how can this be done? How, you may wonder, can we simply revise the boy code? What happens when I teach my son to be sensitive and empathic, and he comes home with a broken nose? While it certainly is not easy, many mothers are indeed finding ways to fight back, buck the code, and foster sons who are both close to them as mothers and successful within their contemporary peer culture. Sarah and Evan. Sarah, the 40-something mother of two, had let the boy code talk her into constraining her feelings for Max, her first son. A lot of her friends, including her first husband, had chided her for being too clingy with Max. And so she had decided to back away from the boy, to be less soft with him. Max had grown distant from her, gotten involved in drugs, and ended up going to college thousands of miles away from home. Disappointed in herself for letting society's old-fashioned rules tell her how to raise her son, she decided that when she gave birth to another boy in her second marriage, she would listen to her own intuitions about being a mother. This time, I did things differently. Evan was a lot like Max was, rambunctious, independent, high energy. But for all his rough play, he's always loved to run back to my lap, have me stroke his hair, and tell him stories about my childhood. With Max, I wasn't allowed to indulge in this. My first husband would never have allowed it. But my second husband, Jim, encourages me. And now Evan is 12, and he and I are super close. "It sounds like you're doing a great job this second time around," I told Sarah, as she proudly smiled back at me. "Well, it hasn't always been easy, but we're doing it. I'll never forget this one time when his third-grade teacher wrote me a note expressing concern that Evan seemed to enjoy playing the girls' games at recess and wanted to try out for the starring role in the class play, even though it was the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz. I thought to myself, oh God, here we go. That sounds pretty tough. What did you do about it? Oh, I dealt with that teacher and the other parents all right. Evan and I always had too much of a meaningful relationship to sacrifice to their rigidity. All I had to do was think about how difficult things had become with Max, and I found the courage to go in there and tell them that Evan could play the wizard, the scarecrow, or Dorothy, as far as I was concerned. It sounds as though you handled the situation pretty well. Well, in private, I remember explaining to Evan that sometimes society is hard on boys, that girls these days are usually allowed to be more experimental and expressive. You know, if some girl wanted to play the wizard, can you imagine anybody complaining? If anybody did, they'd probably be labeled a sexist. So why couldn't Evan play a female role, if that's the one he found most interesting? I told him he might get teased if he played the witch, but that it was fine with me. So what did he decide? Well, actually, he decided to be the lion instead. After we discussed the way other people might have tried to make him feel, he thought it wouldn't be worth the trouble. I was pleased with myself, because instead of just snapping at him and telling him he'd have to play a different part, we talked really openly about the situation, and he decided to handle it how he thought best. "Not bad for a boy who was only in the third grade at the time," I told Sarah. "You bet," she said. "In fact, now that he's a teenager, he's just this really great kid. He seems like he's much more popular with his peers than Max was. He's close to a number of girls, and his teachers report he's one of the best-behaved and most caring boys in the whole class." Of course, Sarah and other mothers who are bucking gender stereotypes worry that such a wonderfully empathic boy will barely survive within the peer culture, where conformity and macho ideals may still squeeze out boys whose emotionally expressive and caring capacities are still intact. Yet, though this is a very real challenge for mothers, Sarah shows us that it's not an impossible one. As Sarah and I discussed, by not shaming Evan for his dependency needs and meeting his desire for a close mother-son relationship, and by standing up for him when his teacher tried to hit him with the boy code, Sarah gave her son wonderful gifts that will last his lifetime. Strong social skills, empathy for others, and the kind of positive, self-confident personality that attracts friends. And because he remained connected with his mother and was comfortable discussing things with her, Evan will probably have richer, more satisfying relationships with women than most men do. Since he has not been straitjacketed by the rigid code of masculinity, Evan will be more flexible in his behavior. But it's no mystery that gentle, so-called feminine attributes still do not have widespread approval, especially among adolescent boys, many of whom are hiding their own tremendous insecurity about their masculinity behind a mask of coolness, and are all too willing to taunt and abuse anyone who drops the pose of cool. But I believe that even for adolescent boys, women like Sarah can continue to play a very important role, helping them adjust to peer culture and the boy code in a healthy way. The crucial thing to remember is that simply because a boy like Evan can be gentle and low-key doesn't mean he always has to be. In short, Evan can learn to choose when and how to express his full emotional capacities. For instance, Evan deliberately chose not to play the role of the witch to avoid the taunting he'd face if he followed through with his original choice. Likewise, Evan can learn to temporarily hide his vulnerable emotions when he's out with the football team, and express himself more freely in safer contexts, such as when he's among his closest friends, or with his mom. In a similar way, women have learned to compete in previously all-male arenas by learning new codes of behavior that they apply in a limited context, such as on the job. When a woman is the head of a bank, she doesn't cry on the job, but she might very well cry if her close friend went bankrupt and couldn't pay her debts. In short, women have learned to broaden their emotional repertoire and apply responses that are appropriate for the situation in which they find themselves. Boys obviously can too. In fact, Evan will probably feel freer than other adolescent boys who have been more constrained by gender straitjackets. He may feel freer than most boys to pursue whatever interests he may have, football, cooking, or even playing female parts in theatrical productions. If his passions lead him outside the few rigid areas that the boy code says are appropriate, he will probably have the self-assurance to buck the stereotypes with humor and grace. When I talk about a boy choosing when to show his more sensitive side, I don't mean the process I described of boys adopting a mask, a forced persona, to hide shame and insecurity. there's a crucial difference between the two. Evan will not be forced to wear a mask out of fear or shame, because he has been allowed to develop a genuine deep sense of self that enables him to freely and selectively choose when it's safe to show the side of his personality that is outside the boy code. Some parents actually stand up for their boys and try to encourage other adults to see the downside of gender straitjacketing. For instance, when Sarah and I spoke further, she explained that when she met resistance from Evan's third-grade teacher, she scheduled a talk with her and Evan's other teachers. She thought carefully about how to explain her position. She told the teachers that she valued Evan's creativity and his caring quality, and that she had worked hard to ensure that they survived. She gave a few examples of things she loved about Evan, and after a while the teachers joined in. They talked for a while about how cooperative, empathic, and fun Evan was. Then Sarah asked the teachers to help her maintain the development of those qualities and to communicate with her about them. "At first, I don't think I changed their minds a bit," says Sarah. "I'm not sure I could have done that. But I started a good discussion among us, and now Evan is doing wonderfully." Like Sarah, other mothers can become a new breed of coach for the less open-minded and help make the world safer for sensitive boys. Her love and unconditional support of her son can be a powerful counterpart to the shaming messages society delivers. Boys with single mothers. Among some of our best coaches in this area are women who raise sons without fathers due to divorce, a father's death, or simply the choice of single motherhood. Because they are even more likely to be subjected to our culture's discomfort with close mother-son relationships than women in two-parent families, single mothers tend to focus very carefully on what they are doing to raise their boys and how this affects them as they grow into men. Single mothers say they are almost universally counseled to find the boy a male role model, as if a mother cannot possibly raise her son alone, as if she will be unable to convey some vital secret about masculinity. Single mothers are particularly warned against being physically affectionate with their sons, as if any physical contact will automatically become sexual, simply because there's no father in the house. Many single mothers I've met and counseled find it extremely hard to sort through this issue, to trust in their own ability to raise a son and to feel comfortable showing him affection. As a result, they may be more likely than other mothers to pull back from intimacy with their sons, which is unfortunate, because these boys have no other parent to turn to for a closer relationship. But I believe most single mothers have excellent instincts about what to say and do, and about when to ask others for help, to ensure that their sons will grow into healthy young men. Single mothers, I believe, have a lot of good things to teach the rest of us about boys and masculinity. Olivia and George. Olivia found there was really only one time she needed to call on her ex-husband for help with George, now 14 years old. "I remember calling my husband when George was still toilet training and saying, 'When you're up here, can you show George how to stand over the toilet and pee? He's getting to the age where he can do that, but he's never seen a man naked, so how is he supposed to know how?' It wasn't that there weren't other times Olivia wished her husband were around to handle specific parenting issues, but who among us, male or female, hasn't occasionally wanted to hand tough parenting challenges to someone else? For example, Olivia remembers her reluctance to talk with her son about sex. I'll never forget it. A year ago, when George was only 13 years old, I came home from work one day and found him and his girlfriend in his room by themselves. I knew I had to talk about sex with him again, and soon. At that point, I really, really wished his father were there to do it. I wish I could have just gone off and made dinner and said, "Dear, you handle this. You know how to handle boys." But I couldn't. "What did you end up doing?" I asked. "Well, the upside is that we had a good talk, all about sex and relationships. We got through it. If we could get through that, we'll get through anything." Other single mothers take charge. Olivia is not alone in her gifts as a single mother. Another mother told me she found it difficult, as a woman, to intervene in the supreme bastion of masculinity, sports. But she handled it well. When a coach verbally abused her son, Chad, after he fell and injured himself, Deborah took action. I called the athletic director of the school, which is not something that a mother does, she explained. Certainly you don't do it lightly. For a year afterwards, I had parents come up and say that was a very courageous thing to do, and very risky. That was quite courageous, I agreed. Well, Deborah told me, sports directors and coaches hate to see mothers meddling. They can get quite condescending and patronizing to mothers, and I think parents fear they will take it out on their sons. But it actually had positive results. The coach was remorseful about what he did to Chad, and the athletic director has been working on coaching styles. It still has a long way to go, but I'm glad I stuck up for my boy. Deborah has also had to manage Chad's tendency to feel that he should be the man of the family. Occasionally, Chad has tried to advise me on what to do with the family money or tell me how I should be running my business. I think he gets it in his head from somewhere that a family needs a male in charge. I tolerate it, and he gets over it pretty quickly. He figures out I'm doing okay. Clearly, these single mothers are managing and managing well. Single mothers face challenges to their authority from coaches, other parents, and especially their sons. While facing down these challenges and defying the gender stereotypes that say women can't raise sons, single mothers open doors for all of us. Of course, any parent knows that a second set of hands, a second adult presence, is helpful for surviving and thriving. And it probably helps if the two adults have complementary capacities to better split up the work and present a model for a broader range of behavior for children. But in many respects, the gender of those individuals is less significant than we had often imagined. The real issue for the son of a single mother, or the son of any mother for that matter, is not the presence or absence of a man in the house, but the mother's attitude toward men in general. A woman who exudes hostility toward men can confuse her developing son's sense of his own gender. A son can also be confused if his mother is passively dependent on men and gets involved with men who are controlling and aggressive. But then, similar damage to a son's development is done by fathers who exhibit unhealthy aspects of masculinity, such as aggressive, controlling behavior toward their wives. In short, a single mother with adequate self-esteem and a healthy attitude toward men can be a wonderful parent of a son. We witnessed the phenomenon of well-adjusted families headed by mothers during World War II, when many sons had fathers who were absent for years. The boys did not become emasculated or effeminate in the predominantly female world in which they lived, but were perfectly able to develop healthy attitudes about their masculinity. I would suggest that they were helped because of their mother's overwhelmingly positive attitude toward their soldier fathers. The entire country, mothers included, were proud of their men, sure that their strong masculinity was enabling them to fight effectively for a just cause. Mothers who have a positive attitude toward other men in their lives will naturally allow them into their mother-son relationship, thus broadening the boy's exposure to father substitutes. This is helpful not because single mothering interferes with the development of masculinity, or because boys somehow require testosterone-charged models, but rather because bringing adult male friends into a boy's life simply means there will be more love to go around. By exposing her son to several empathic adult mentors, a single mother can shepherd her son along a healthy journey toward manhood. The internal confusion, working on your own assumptions about boys. Most mothers, whether single or not, know just the kind of boy they want to raise, and their struggle involves reconciling that ideal image with the one the old boy code still tells them is more appropriate. But sometimes it's not society that's affecting a mother's attitude, but rather her own internal confusion about what she considers a good, healthy, masculine boy. Sometimes a mother's own best ideals about equality between the sexes are tainted by her own unresolved confusion over masculinity. A mother might say she wants her boy to be sensitive, but her deeper, sometimes unconscious feelings might want her boy to be tough and athletic. In the same way, a woman might state that she wants a kind, sensitive man for a partner, but she might instead consistently choose to date men in the Rhett Butler macho style. She may be so imbued with society's ambivalence about masculinity that she has trouble giving her son a consistent, helpful message. Mixed messages increase a son's confusion and sense of shame over his own masculinity, as he finds himself unable to live up to a mother's ambiguous messages about what a man should be. To avoid this painful dilemma, I suggest moms try to look within themselves to examine their own ideas about masculinity. That journey is probably not complete until they have examined their own histories and thought about the men who probably taught them the most about masculinity, their fathers. If a woman grew up with a silent or absent father, as was common, for instance, in the 1950s, she may be uncomfortable with men who are expressive. She may find herself unconsciously, yet consistently, blocking her son from expressing his feelings. Another common role that fathers in the previous generation adopted was the covertly seductive father, the one who adored his little girl and felt free to comment on her appearance, clothes, and figure. As Ellen Kashek has argued, this covert seductiveness has damaged many women in our culture, leaving them with the idea that their self-esteem is wrapped up in their ability to be attractive to men. A mother with this sort of history may find herself unconsciously being flirtatious with her adolescent son, believing in some deep-seated way that this is the only way to relate to a man. Far more common than the sexually seductive mother, however, is the mother who pulls back from a relationship with her boy out of fear of being inappropriate, or simply out of a sense of strangeness. The most well-meaning mother may feel that she doesn't know how to achieve intimacy with a boy, especially when he reaches puberty and suddenly begins to look very much like a man. Fear of Freud's Oedipus complex haunts the most healthy of mother-son relationships. And yet, at this point, a boy may vitally need his mother as a mentor as he negotiates this all-important life passage. Much of a mother's inner conflict and confusion could be eliminated, I believe, if we as a society were to clarify our expectations about what it means today to be a man, what we really hope for from our boys and men. My years of counseling boys and their parents make it clear that we don't really want our boys to move across the country, live apart from us, and never call, although part of a mythic view of manhood is that boys must go through some solitary hardening ritual, some heroic mission, to prove their courage and solidify their masculinity. In Greek legend, Odysseus doesn't see his family, including his son Telemachus, for 20 years as his journey home from the Trojan War is extended by adversity and many adventures. In our more recent mythology, we have figures such as the Lone Ranger, who ride around the West performing heroic feats, unfettered by wives and children. And commercials tell us that any young boy can become a real man by joining the Marines, getting physically tough and proving himself on the battlefield. But these mythic images of solitary men no longer serve us. We live in an interdependent world, so that even the best corporate executives, heroic men of strong vision and action, sink or swim on their ability to work with others. We also live in a world where traveling even long distances is relatively quick and easy, and communicating over these distances is even quicker and easier, so that we don't need to be training our boys or any other group of our citizens to withstand long, lonely, dangerous journeys. It's time we rethink the merits of our old-fashioned male archetypes, the distant warrior, the lone adventurer, the fearless hero, and reconsider what we really want from our boys and men. I would suggest that most people's image of a healthy male is one who can succeed on the job, on the athletic field, and in relationships, and change diapers. What we really want is for our boys to become strong, authentic individuals, to become capable both of acting heroically and of maintaining strong, affectionate relationships to spouses, children, parents, co-workers, neighbors, and friends. Mothers are a key to this, and to helping our boys mature into self-respecting men who don't need to cut off relational ties. If they refuse to give in to society's outdated myths about the need for separation, and instead let it be known loudly and clearly that they want to nurture boys to become emotionally open human beings, mothers give the message to young and adolescent boys that there's no reason to sever their mother-son ties, no reason to harden themselves, and no reason to become the kind of emotionally disconnected adult male who will be disliked by many women. Carl, a real boy. A good example of a real boy is Carl, a bright, gregarious, and athletic high school senior who is extremely close to his extended family of Russian Jewish heritage, and an expert at negotiating within it. Carl spoke about how he chose to attend a prestigious college in a nearby state. My guidance counselor told me that with my grades and my football record, I had a lot of places to choose from, which is just great. But it made my decision really hard, Carl explained. When I told my parents about what he said, chaos broke out at the dinner table. Dad told me that I should try for an Ivy League school. I mean, here's someone who stowed away on a boat at age 12 to get to this country and has busted his butt ever since. I could just see the stars in his eyes as he thought Yale. Then my mother jumped in, he continued. She started praising the local university, which is good, but not as good as she wanted to think. I could almost see her thinking, my baby's moving away. My brother Danny started yelling at me to choose a school with a good football team. You know what was on his mind. He wanted me to be a star so he could tell all his friends. I mean, it was pretty funny, all these people talking at once, each telling me what they wanted for me. I started teasing them about it. I said, come on, Dad, you just want to drive around with one of those Yale stickers on your car. And Danny, you just want to watch me on TV. And oh, Ma, don't you think I'll survive without your cooking? We all ended up laughing, and of course, in the end, I didn't choose any of the schools they wanted. But I am at a school Dad's proud of, and I'm close enough to come home on weekends. As for football, who needs it? It gets too rough at the college level. As Carl impressed on us, the presence of supportive relationships does not hamper a boy's ability to become his own individual self. Carl is easily able to identify and act on his own interests, despite the fact that his family is close and all too ready to offer their own opinions. The lasting positive benefits of a close relationship with parents. When I counsel couples, I am often struck by the fact that many of the skills required to succeed in adult relationships are those we resist teaching to growing boys. Skills of connection, empathy, negotiation, and compromise, instead of competitiveness. The ability to be dependent and vulnerable and to share one's troubles, instead of the ability to keep a stiff upper lip and handle pain alone. And these are the very skills mothers are told by society not to encourage in boys, who may therefore grow into men who, in turn, insist that their boys also do without these skills. I cannot stress enough that it's not mothers who are crippling our boys' masculinity. It's society's myths about manhood that are preventing boys from being seen and trained as whole human beings. Men who can work effectively and live in close relationships with other people. Research actually shows that men who are able to develop their emotional lives more fully are physically and psychologically healthier than men who are not. For example, in a study conducted at Wellesley College, Rosalind Barnett found that young adult men with close relationships to their parents had lower levels of psychological distress. In addition, such men reported that they did not feel that their parents were too intrusive. Clearly, these men had found ways to continue relating closely with their parents and to rely on this closeness in a healthy way to succeed in their adult lives. Other Western cultures are now teaching us about interesting aspects of masculinity and the positive impact mothers may have on their sons. For instance, for adult sons in Italy, mamismo, meaning being a mama's boy, is not a mark of shame. According to the Italian National Statistics Institute, in 1997, over 58% of Italian boys between the ages of 18 and 34 may live with their mothers. And these mothers and sons vehemently support their right to stay connected. As one young man argued, it's better to be loved at an older age than abandoned at an early age. The kids who leave home at 13 or 14 in England are the ones missing something in terms of affection. An Italian mother agrees, the problems come more from a lack of affection than an excess of it. You don't find people who are psychologically unbalanced because they get too much love or protection at home. Interdependence, a delicate balance between parent and son. In healthy mother-son relationships, there simply does not seem to be anything as too much love. Yes, some mothers and sons can potentially fall into a relationship in which parent and child vacillate between extremes of dependence and independence in an unhealthy way. But I believe most mothers and their sons are capable of creating strong, healthy relationships based instead on interdependence, the recognition that each of us has ties to and relies on other people, but that each of us is also responsible for our own actions and selves. Parents simply need to be careful not to put their own needs and desires ahead of their sons, and not to attempt to manipulate his emotions, to guilt or shame him into doing what they want. Faced with a demanding and controlling parent, a son may feel he has no choice but to either knuckle under or move across country and forget to leave a forwarding address. In short, mothering and fathering involves striking a delicate balance between supporting a child and allowing him to grow on his own. A mother operates most effectively on instinct, on when to intervene and when to let go. The best guide in almost every case is the child himself. A mother naturally learns to read the child's cues, remaining as a steady, secure base while the child negotiates the next step of independence. She doesn't intrude when the child is doing well on his own. She doesn't move away when the child reaches out for comfort. She doesn't flee if he momentarily pushes her away. A mother's best guide is her own knowledge of her child, gained through countless daily interactions. But this process of learning a healthy interdependence, which seems so simple in theory, may be quickly inhibited when our boy and his mother fall under the inevitable sway of the boy code. As we saw in Chapter 2, little Johnny Martin clearly still very much needed to lean on his mother, yet he was not allowed to need his mother on the first day of kindergarten. He was humiliated by the depth of a normal dependency that others, including all the experts, were telling him a 5-year-old shouldn't have. And so what happens is that the boy himself begins to pull away from his mother. It's not just that mother feels pressured by society to let go and does. A boy also feels this cultural pressure, and he too may push mom and many of the emotional skills she's trying to teach him far, far away. And so what should be a son's process of learning a healthy interdependence becomes instead one of learning an abrupt, unhealthy, even traumatic independence. Because of the boy code, instead of teaching connection, we end up teaching disconnection. Different styles and languages of love. Talking versus doing. Another result of the boy code is that boys, as we've seen, tend to develop their own style of showing their love and affection that is generally quite different from that of girls, and thus from that of their mothers. This is critical for a mom to remember, because though it may hardly look like what she would do to rekindle a relationship, a boy, even after a traumatic separation from her, may reach out to reconnect. He may do this, rather than asking for it, by seeking out his mother's company in playful activities. As we've already discussed, a boy's natural language is usually action language. He tends to be best at showing his love, affection, and empathy through action. Thus, for boys who create friendships by doing things together, empathy and love can emerge simply from a shared game of baseball, a joint building project, or a walk around the block. Sometimes mothers may make the mistake of discounting such activities because they seem to involve little of the verbal intimacy, the talk, that most women prize. But many boys gain a significant sense of support and comfort from these activities, and ideally, a mom is attuned to this fact. which is why I believe mothers can learn to connect with their sons simply by hanging out and sharing an activity. How can I get him to talk to me? Reconnecting through car therapy. Gwen learned about boys' relational styles quite accidentally. She had been saddened that David, her 13-year-old son, didn't talk to her as openly as he used to. But she was stymied in her attempts to change that. One day, when her husband was working late, she took on his job of driving David to hockey practice. In the car on the way home, after talking about the scrimmage, David started talking about his friends on the team and eventually wandered into a discussion about marijuana. Gwen was surprised when he opened up so much. "Something about the car," she mused. "The darkness outside, the coziness inside, the way he could just stop talking and look out the window if he wanted to, all of it created a setting where he felt more comfortable talking." From now on, she says, she makes sure she shares the driving duties with her husband. "It's car therapy. For both of us," she says, laughing. Many mothers find that if they engage in action-oriented activities with their sons, their boys begin to open up and talk. Claudia, for instance, spoke to me of her 10-year-old Scott, who often comes home from school in what she refers to as a really bad mood. "When he's in one of these moods," she explains, "he just seems to want to turn on the TV and tune out from reality." If she asks him what's wrong, he either ignores me or tells me to get lost. But Claudia soon developed a strategy for getting Scott to share the feelings behind the mood. "I can usually get him to be much more expressive if I invite him to just do something with me. Like we'll play ping-pong in our family room, go outside and throw a frisbee, whatever. Once we get going, his mood seems to change. Lots of times, after we've been playing for a while, he'll come over to me and start talking about stuff. He doesn't always tell me everything that's going on with him, but I often have the feeling he's getting the emotional release he really needs." The timed silence syndrome of boys. Mothers are usually more willing to sit down and talk about their feelings, and so a boy's relationship pattern might seem frustrating. But in fact, the pattern can in some ways be anticipated and planned for. And it is different from what is typical for girls. The most challenging time for communication, the time when mothers and sons are most likely to disconnect, although in their hearts they may long to connect even more closely, is when a boy is hurting. I have found that when boys suffer a blow to their self-esteem or otherwise feel sad or disappointed, they often follow a pattern that I call the timed silence syndrome. A boy's first reaction is to retreat and be alone to nurse his hurt. If a mother presses him with concerned questions at that point, it only intensifies his sense of shame and causes him to retreat further or more angrily. In many cases, it's only after he has had time to sit with his own pain that he becomes ready to come back and talk about it. At that point, his approach might be so subtle that his mother could easily miss it. And my studies show that if a parent misses that moment, the opportunity to connect about that episode might take a while to come around again. A caring mother could misunderstand this pattern. When her son walks into the house, obviously upset about something, a sympathetic mom may immediately want to talk about it. When the boy says, "Leave me alone," she may feel rebuffed, or she may push for connection when it simply won't happen. Then, when the boy comes back to her and makes a cautious overture, indicating he might want to talk, she may miss his subtle cues, particularly if she's still bothered by the previous rebuff, angry that her son was rude, frustrated that she doesn't know how to help him. In fact, his initial gruff, "Leave me alone," may simply be an indication of how badly he's hurting, and may really be an indirect call to his mother to be there for him, but later. Maria and Carlos. Maria Cortez, a Boston mother who participated in my study, told me the following story. Carlos came home one day and told me that he had lost a soccer game at school. In the past, whenever something like this happened, I tried to get him to talk about it. "Leave me be," he would tell me. "I don't want to talk about this." I used to try to pressure him, but then he would get really mad, go into his room, and slam the door. "So how did you handle things this time around?" I asked. "Well," Maria continued, "this time I tried something else. I just said, 'Sorry to hear that,' and then waited for a chance to just hang out with him. After he took his shower and got into some fresh clothes, I asked him if he wanted to go take a walk and get some ice cream. We started walking together and making jokes about some of the goofy people on the street. When things felt comfortable, I simply said, 'Hey, sorry the game didn't work out today.' 'How did that go?' I asked. 'I could not believe it,' Maria said, her eyes widening, her head nodding. 'Carlos looked at me, you know, right in the face with those puppy dog eyes of his, and said, "Ma, I feel so bad about it. I feel like such a failure." I gave him a big hug. I realized that the best way to get him to talk to me and tell what's up for him is to just go out walking or something. From now on, that's what I'm always going to do." As Maria found out, boys often respond best to their mother's attempts at closeness when they can set the timing, when they're free to follow a period of silence with one of action. Maria learned that she can't push her son into talking when he doesn't want to, and this is particularly true for adolescent boys who feel a tremendous need for personal space and privacy. Mothers need to listen closely to a boy's more subtle, action-oriented language and be available to talk on the boy's schedule, not on their own. The mother tongue. Of course, a woman's more typical style of relating through talk is useful, too. At times, a mother will be able to bond with her son through sharing her feelings verbally, and her talent for this will serve a boy well. I think a mother should take every opportunity to teach her boy the mother tongue, as psychoanalyst Jim Herzog refers to it, gently pushing a boy to stretch his capacity to talk about feelings, a process that ideally starts when boys are very young. A mother might say, "I remember how awful I felt when I didn't make the softball team. I felt like the biggest klutz." Or a mother might take the opportunity to acknowledge uncomfortable feelings, such as sadness and shame in everyday life, with a statement such as, "I was so upset when my supervisor criticized me at the meeting today, in front of everyone." In this way, a mother demonstrates that sadness, shame, and vulnerability are natural, inevitable feelings, a part of living, and that they feel just a little less awful when they can be put into words and shared with a friend. Finally, a mother can often use her specialized skills to help her son find words to express his deepest feelings. So, for example, when her son comes home and punches the wall to relieve his anger, she might help him explore other feelings, such as sadness and disappointment, by asking, "Are you okay? Are you feeling disappointed about something? Could something be getting you down?" Mothers and fathers working together to transcend the stereotypes. Obviously, the best parenting of sons will be achieved when mothers and fathers transcend gender straitjackets, in actions as well as words. Unfortunately, in real life, couples tend to split up roles, with each partner doing whatever he or she feels most comfortable with. This can lead to a pernicious pattern where mothers do more nurturing and daily care, and fathers do more disciplining. The real problem with such a pattern is that it perpetuates the rigid gender stereotypes we hope to teach boys to overcome. One way gender stereotypes get stuck is that some mothers unconsciously play the role of gatekeeper, preventing a father from getting involved in parenting. Nina and Mark. When they entered counseling, Nina and Mark epitomized the dilemma of gatekeeping, a phenomenon we'll discuss in greater detail in Chapter 6, with Nina complaining bitterly that Mark was not more involved with the children. Mark exploded, "What am I supposed to do? Every time I try to help, she tells me I'm not doing it right." "What do you mean exactly?" I asked Mark. "For example," he explained, "the other day I was trying to diaper the baby. The Velcro stuck to his leg, and he gave a little squawk. In a flash, Nina was there, scooping the baby out of my hands, asking, 'What did you do to him?' as if I were torturing him, for God's sake." "How did you respond to that?" "I left Nina and the baby and tried to help Matthew, our 9-year-old, with his math homework. And before I knew it, she was criticizing that too, telling me I was helping too much and giving him all the answers. Whenever I do something, I can just see her in the background wincing, as if I'm ruining the kids for life." "Do you feel you do have an important role with the boys?" I asked. "The only thing she lets me do is be the bad guy. I come home and she tells me I have to talk to Matthew about his manners. Why can't she do it?" "You're his father," Nina responded. "You know how to talk to boys better than I do." In this case, we had to address Nina's strong desire to be the perfect mother to her children. She was a professional woman who had chosen to stay home with her 2 boys, and it was hard for her to admit that her husband, who saw his children only in the evenings and weekends, could be as good a parent as she was. And in truth, she was quite right when she said that Mark was not as skilled at physically taking care of a baby or at reading his older child's emotional needs. Mark, in turn, finally realized that sometimes he colluded with Nina, playing dumb at childcare, so she would take over and let him return to his newspaper. We emphasized that Mark had the right and the need to learn his own style of interacting with his children. Over several weeks, Nina learned to ask Mark for help with the children and then to be less hypervigilant about how he accomplished it. They found it worked best when Nina physically left the room, so she wasn't wincing and shrugging in the background, and also so that Mark had no possibility of getting help. He struggled through on his own and found he enjoyed the sense of accomplishment and intimacy that resulted. Nina and Mark also had to address what they had learned from their own families about parents' roles. Nina's father had been a strict, distant man. She remembered her father would yell and punish her, and afterward she could always run to her mother for a hug and cuddle. She realized she was replicating that pattern, which allowed her to always be the good, loving parent, by forcing Mark into being the authority figure. But this ultimately undermined his ability to be intimate with his children. Mark, in turn, resented playing the role of authority figure because his own father had been so ineffectual. When Mark's father was home, which was rare, he had read a book to the children or kissed them good night so absent-mindedly that Mark wasn't sure he even knew which child he was dealing with. Mark's mother had run the house with a firm hand, so Mark really felt subconsciously that Nina should take care of all discipline problems. Nina and Mark were able to recognize these patterns and gradually work to improve them. Nina learned to set limits more effectively. Mark learned to take a greater role in all areas of parenting. Of course, they did not magically become equal partners. Nina will always have a somewhat fierce protectiveness of her sons, as compared with Mark's lackadaisical style. Changing one's typical style takes constant work. In their case, as in many others, the reward for the work is a greater sense of comradeship as parents, and a greater sense of intimacy with their children. In addition, the boys are learning something about appropriate gender roles, i.e., that both mother and father can be responsible for nurturing and setting limits. Such modeling will help the boys keep an open mind toward gender roles. Parents should discuss issues of masculinity and agree in principle on how to raise their sons, but they need not worry if they don't do things exactly the same way. As Nina and Mark show, parents can have very different styles. A son can get different things from each parent, ultimately learning more. Tips on today's mothering. How to stay close and still prepare him for the real world. We've seen that moms face several hurdles in raising boys today. First, they must struggle with the constant pressure they feel to separate from their sons when in their hearts they yearn to stay close to them. Second, they're put into a catch-22 situation because though they are expected to raise boys to be loving and sensitive, they're also expected to prepare their sons for the real world, where they may get teased, taunted, or shamed if they show their loving or sensitive sides. And third, as their boys get older, moms have to deal with the ways in which their sons, in response to society's shaming messages about masculinity, begin to harden themselves and thus resist their mother's overtures at closeness and connection. I often suggest that a mother use the following strategies to deal with these challenges and to forge a closer, more successful relationship with her sons. Talk openly about the boy code. It's just about impossible to conquer any problem if it's never discussed. So talk openly about the boy code with your son. Tell him what you like and don't like about it. Discuss the new double standard of masculinity that calls on boys to be nice guys, but then pushes them to act like toughies. Tell your boy about the bind that places you in as a parent. Explain how much you'd like him to become an empathic, caring man, but also be sure to discuss what you know about the real world, and share with him how hard a place you know it can be. If your son believes that you really do understand what it's like for him within male peer culture, that you understand the ways that he can get teased and mistreated for breaking the old boy code, he'll be more open to learning the empathy and other emotional skills you're probably eager to impart to him. This may sometimes mean admitting defeat. In other words, sometimes you may suggest an approach to a problem a boy is experiencing with his peers, and your solution may simply fail. For example, suppose one of your son's best friends begins to turn on your boy, to tease and taunt your son rather than continue to be friendly with him. Suppose, too, that when your son shares this problem with you, you advise him to simply remind his friend how much the friendship means to him, and to insist that his friend cut out the teasing. And finally, suppose your son comes home and tells you that he tried out your advice, but that the teasing only got worse. Here lies the rub. Your boy will tend to feel betrayed and alone with his pain. If you follow all this by simply insisting that your suggested solution will work. Instead, tell your son how sorry you are that your approach didn't work out. Suggest other ideas, or perhaps better yet, ask him how he thinks he should handle the situation and try your very best to support him. His approach might be quite different from the one you might tend to propose. Perhaps he'll try ignoring his friend for a while. Perhaps he'll tell his buddy that if he doesn't cut out the teasing, he'll be in for it. Your son's approach may not be quite the one you're most comfortable with, but it simply can't be forgotten that your son is doing the best he can to deal with the boy code, with all its harsh imperatives about masculinity. So just as it is important to discuss and critique the boy code with your son, it's also critical to remember that your son is under enormous pressure to conform to it. So speak openly about the boy code and stand behind your son as he does all he can to rebel against it and to succeed within it. Teach others about the problem of the boy code. As they confront the old boy code, mothers often tell me with a sigh of resignation that they feel there's nothing they can do to change it. I constantly hear things such as, "You can't change boys," or, "If they hear it at school, it's all over," or, "Once adolescence hits, it's in their blood, that's it." These kinds of helpless statements derive directly from the myths of boyhood we've already discussed. But in my opinion, there is a lot mothers can do to change things. First and most important, talk to your friends, neighbors, and families about the boy code. Tell them what you know about how it operates and what it does to limit our boys. Explain your approach to handling it. Second, educate the educators about the boy code. As we'll discuss later in this book, teachers and school faculties need to learn about boys' peer culture, too. Boys spend years of their lives in these institutions. If you sense that the schools your boys attend are not focused on boys' emotional needs and aren't attuned to how these needs can get ignored because of society's rules about masculinity, take time to teach what you know to the men and women who spend their days educating your sons. Finally, a big part of teaching others about society's harsh imperatives about boys and masculinity is to stand up and rebel against them. In other words, it's not enough simply to talk in a neutral way about them. In this chapter, we heard from several mothers who successfully bucked the stereotypes. Much in the way that mothers led the way to paving new opportunities for their daughters, it may be mothers who will show us the way to help boys feel freer as they grow into men. Teach your son about masculinity by talking about the men you love and why you love them. One of the best ways you can help give your son a clear, healthy message about masculinity is to talk to him in a positive way about the men you and he care about. Your husband, your father, an uncle, a close friend of the family, or any man both you and your boy can feel good about. As your boy struggles to fulfill society's confusing expectations about masculinity, you can provide clarity by discussing the qualities you admire in these men. "What a warm person your Uncle Charlie is," you might tell your son. Or, "What I really love about your father is that he ignores what everybody says about how to dress and just does his own thing. Don't you love that funny hat he wears?" Or, "You know that Pete next door? I just think it's great the way he blasts that opera from the windows when he's mowing the lawn. What a neat, creative guy." By hearing the way you appreciate these men, your boy can develop his own sense of the kind of man he would like to be and feel more confident about breaking the rigid stereotypes he's bombarded with all day long. On the flip side, be careful not to add to your boy's confusion by saying what you don't like about the men around you, at least not in a hostile tone. While it may be appropriate to share in a limited way aspects of these men that disappoint you, it can be very damaging to a boy's sense of male confidence if he's constantly